Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
What is the malted liquor? What gets you drunker quicker? What comes in bottles or in cans?
Beer.
Can't get enough of it.
Beer.
How we really love it.
Beer.
Makes me think I'm a man.
Beer.
I could kiss and hug it.
Beer.
But I'd rather chuck it.
Beer.
Got my belly out to here.
Beer.
I could not refuse
beer.
It. I could really use a beer.
Beer. Beer.
Beer. Beer. Beer. Beer. Beer.
Good morning. This week, it is all about beer and brewing. Coming up, our special guest this week is Chris, who is a thermodynamic expert and now chief brewer. And he is going to be telling us all of his top tips for how to make your own home brews, common mistakes, and what the process is, explaining all of that. We've also got some exciting science news and our riddle for this week. Well, I thought I would just stick with the oldest riddle of time, which is, what is the best hangover cure? And I don't think anyone knows. So if you think you've got the best hangover cure, you can tweet us at Soho Radio. I don't know, for me, I just tend to eat salty food. That tends to be my favourite. Joining us today in the studio as well, we have Kyle, guest producer. You already have a top tip about some research that you saw to do with Guinness glasses, don't you?
Yeah, so after finding out today that you're talking about beer, I heard about this research that they've did that was published quite not quite recently, a few years ago, and it was about how the shape of a glass affects the head on a beer. So what they did is they analyzed a Guinness glass, like that traditional Guinness shape that you see in all the adverts and things.
Yeah.
And they looked at how the bubbles form in the bottom of the glass and compared that to other shapes of glass, like so just straight up and down, or what they called an anti-Guinness glass.
So it's like fat at the bottom and narrow at the top.
Yeah, so like an upside down Guinness glass. And they did this analysis and they found out that actually the shape of the Guinness glass is optimized to form bubbles in the beer. And so it keeps the head on your Guinness longer.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And I'm not even sure if they designed it like that. It just, you know, maybe by trial and error.
They were just like, this is the best glass.
Yeah, this is the one that holds the head the longest. So they managed to just figure it out.
And it's all to do with bubble stability.
Exactly. Yeah.
That is crazy. I'd love that to be my research, you know, looking at beer glasses all day.
Yeah.
That sounds really fun.
I'm sure there's a lot of taste testing involved. So.
I mean, you just would have to. Absolutely. Well, on with the show. And we are going to start with probably my favourite song at the moment. It's been my favourite song for a while. I am a huge Kygo fan. And this is Stole the Show.
We used to have it all, but now's our curtain call. So hold for the applause. Oh, 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 oh. And wave out to the crowd and take our final bow. It's our time to go, but at least we stole the show. At least we stole the show. Ooh, at least we stole the show.
Let's hope we're going to steal this show. So, very exciting. I don't know if anyone picked up that. I never normally don't introduce the guest straight away, but that was because there were some slight tube malfunctions, and I can now confirm that Chris has arrived in the studio.
Good morning.
Brilliant. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Great. Yeah, really pleased that you managed to get here. Yeah. And it is now time. You've arrived just in time for...
Science News.
I'm going to start with what I thought was interesting and very beer related. There is now a bar called Alcoholic Architecture where you can get drunk by breathing in and absorbing alcohol through your skin and eyes. So you don't have to drink it. You literally, you go into this room, this fully immersive alcoholic environment, and you just sort of inhale and absorb vaporized spirits. It's spirits and mixes mixed at a 1-3 ratio, and it's they're sort of vaporized in this really pressurized environment. And it's so powerful, you have to wear like protective ponchos to stop your skin from absorbing too much. And you go and you sit in this room, you're only allowed in it for 50 minutes. That's like a health and safety thing. And you get drunk just by absorbing the alcohol. They say that the advantage of this is you are consuming less calories because you don't have to have any of the other sort of sugars in the drink, although alcohol itself is calorific. And they also say that because of the way that you're absorbing the alcohol goes straight into your bloodstream rather than, well, 20% can be normally absorbed in your stomach and 80% is absorbed in your intestine. But because it's going straight into your bloodstream, you get drunk more quickly and your blood alcohol levels are higher, and those are the things that give you the intoxicated effects. So, yeah, everyone go check it out. Bumpers and Pars, a new pop-up. I don't know why I'm promoting them, but yeah, interesting. I just thought that was crazy that you can absorb alcohol.
It's not like something we need another way to drink, another way to get drunk. It's quite funny. The like, I think one of the, they spoke to like a health expert, the Associated Press, and they're like, oh, great. This is all we need now.
No, they spent £30,000 on health and safety, apparently, making sure that all the correct health and safety precautions are followed and everyone is breathing responsibly.
Do they say how you absorb it? Is it mainly through your lungs or?
Skin and eyes.
Skin and eyes. Yeah. And yeah. Eyes?
Apparently so. Sounds painful.
Yeah.
I think that you have a fascinating story about some new whistling language.
Yeah, so there's a community in Turkey, a mountainous region of Turkey. About 10,000 people use this language, which is described as a bird-like whistle. And it's essentially the Turkish language, but done in whistle form. Turkish people who are fluent in Turkish wouldn't be able to understand it unless they've learnt this. But the bizarre thing is that it's found to be the first language that uses both sides of your brain that we know of.
Really?
Yes.
So is it literally like they've taken Turkish words and just made a whistle variety of them?
Yeah, pretty much. It can be heard over long distances, so it's got a kind of resonance to it.
Yeah, I get the kind of the long distances aspect, and that is very useful. But wow, I mean, how many people are sort of speaking this? Is it just a small community?
Yeah, it's about 10,000.
Oh, wow. That's not that small. That is a full-blown language.
Yeah, but the really interesting thing is, as I say, is that it's been found to use both sides of the brain.
Yeah, because typically language is sort of based in the left side of our brain.
Yeah, and that's whether it's, you know, whatever kind of language it is, including sign language and click-based languages, and all throughout human history, as far as we can surmise, all languages have used the left side of the brain. But when they did a classic test that's been used to establish this, where they play a similar sound in both of your ears, so what you hear in your right ear will be processed on the left side of your brain, what you hear in your left ear will be processed on the right side of your brain, people have only been able to identify the language that's been played into their right ear, which is why we thought it was the left side of the brain. But these people, if you play them two distinct sounds, similar but distinct, they'll be able to identify both of the sounds, which has never happened before.
That's amazing. Yeah. Jinx. And then the final piece of science news that we thought was really interesting this week is one for the girls. And there is now an approved female Viagra. You were going to tell us more about this one.
Yes, Amber. Yes. So this is the first ever pill for... I mean, it shouldn't really be called Viagra because it's really nothing like the male equivalent. So Viagra mostly works with... penile dysfunction and doesn't really work on arousal at all, whereas this drug is trying to help women who have problems with arousal, you know,
and libido.
Yeah, so sadly though, when I've looked into it, the drug doesn't really seem to work that well. So like the stats says between 8-13% of women who take the drug experience like a 0.5 more sexually satisfying event in a month. So that's low, only at most 13%.
That's not really the one drug we're hoping for.
And interesting enough, the drug was rejected twice, and it's accepted now despite there being no new experiment. So people are saying that the pharmaceutical company kind of pitched it as this kind of feminist campaign.
Yeah, because it was all about equaling the odds or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, and yeah, that's that was there.
26 versions of, well, Viagra, I'm just going to call it, for them, and nothing on the market for women.
Yeah, so... The really interesting thing is technically actually there is no low, there's no drugs for low male libido. Again, like Viagra only treats erectile dysfunction. So it's quite weird that it's been compared to that, I think. So we'll see what happens. I mean, the drug was initially pitched for trying to deal with depression, but it didn't seem to have much of an effect on that. But it did increase libido. But
drug companies do this though. I remember reading Ben Goldacre's book Bad Science, and what they'll do is they'll make a drug that works for a particular cause, but then once they've made it, they've invested so much money in the manufacture of that, they will maybe just tweak it a little bit rather than start from scratch and find other things they think this drug could work for.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what happened. They were like, they just had this chemical and they were like, oh, let's try it for depression, oh, let's try it for libido.
Yeah.
Even though it's not actually doing much for either of them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, 8 to 13% of women had an effect, so oh, like the rest just didn't do anything for them. So let's you know, can't get too excited in both sense of the word, I guess.
Well, if you want to play along with the experiment this week, we are doing a beer related one involving yeast, which you can buy very easily. Chris, would you please tell the listeners what they would need if they wanted to take part in this experiment?
So all you need for this experiment is some dried yeast, which you can get from any baker's suppliers. You can get baker's yeast or any brewery suppliers. A lot of large shops like Wilkinson's is where I got mine from. Good old Wilko's are now doing a small homebrew range. And it was just £1.50, £1.75, something like that, for some dried yeast in a small sachet.
And you'll also be needing some warm water,
yep,
and a receptacle to put,
yes,
those in.
Yes, so some boiled water, which you then need to leave to cool, or you can mix back with some cold water. A thermometer, preferably, although you can judge it by feel, and some sugar. I'm using dextrose, which is a very simple sugar that brewers use, but any old granulated sugar or caster sugar would work.
So run out to Wilko's now. We're going to put on a song, and when you come back, we will be taking you through our yeast experiment. You've chosen the music today, Chris. I had a little go with the first song, but your next song is Karma by the Black Eyed Peas. Why have you picked this one?
It's a really good song.
That's justification enough.
Yep. Watch out.
Wild tale of a tornado running loose. You tie the noose, I kick the chair. I'm the cyanide that snatch your life while you gasp for air.
Welcome back. You have tuned in just in time for our experiment, which is this week. We are going to bloom some yeast. I'm going to let Chris take the lead on this. So, Chris, what are we doing?
Right. So, if you've got everything that I told you needed, all you need to do is boil up some water, pour it into your glass receptacle. Stick your thermometer in if you're using a thermometer, and
I can confirm that ours is about 37 degrees.
Yep, we're gonna need to bring that down a little bit, but it's a good start. So you're using your boiled water to essentially sterilize everything first off, and then you need to take it down to temperature, so just adding a little bit of cold water. There we go.
Brilliant.
On its way down.
We've got the perfect temperature of 22 degrees going on right now.
And the next thing is to throw in about a tablespoon or so of sugar.
A tablespoon of sugar going, yep, in right now.
I'm using dextrose, which is basically corn sugar, which is a very simple sugar that yeast can metabolise very quickly and easily.
And why is sugar important?
So sugar is what yeast eats. It's what it needs to survive. This dried yeast, which you can hear there, has been kept in, you know, a no sugar environment, and dehydrated completely, so it's completely inactive.
But as soon as you give it water and food, like most things, it's able to start
growing. Like most things, yeah, it'll just straight away should go pretty crazy, and we should see a bloom before the end of the show. So just pouring my, I believe it's 11 grams of yeast.
And that's just sitting on the surface at the moment, just looking kind of brown and scummy. Gorgeous. And giving it a good stir.
We're just using our thermometer, which is stuck in there. And then we're going to cover it over. So it's clinging to here and there a bit. Doesn't really matter. I have some cling film here.
Why is it important for us to cover the yeast?
So to be honest, in this experiment, it isn't really at all. If we were using it to brew, then it would be important because there are microbes in the air, including natural yeasts, as opposed to this yeast, which has been bred and developed over years. To stop those yeasts and other microbes from getting in and infecting the pitch and creating unwanted tastes in our beer. Seeing as how we're not going to be using this yeast to make beer, we're just doing it for a demonstration. It doesn't really matter so much, but it's kind of a force of habit for me. If you're planning on brewing, it's a good habit to get into. Always make sure that you're anything you've sterilized that you then cover.
Brewing is basically a glorified cleaning. Everything needs to be sterilized and then covered. You don't want any other bacteria getting in there. And this is to do with the fermentation process, isn't it? Because you're making the alcohol from the yeast fermenting the sugar. So it ferments sugar, it breaks it down into alcohol. But if other bacteria ferment the sugars, they produce lactic acid, which tastes not nearly as nice.
Yep. Lactic acid, among other things. And then that breaks down further into other things that you don't want the taste of. So yeah, it creates a bit of a knock-on effect.
So what we're hoping to share with this experiment is that within about half an hour, we should be seeing a yeast bloom. And that's just sort of demonstrating how, given the food and given the water, it's growing and it's started the fermentation process. So we'll be checking back on that at the end of the experiment. If you've been able to do this at home, send us a picture of yours. And now, moving on from this, Chris, can you tell me exactly, like, how do we make beer? So I get that the yeast is going to be fermenting and forming alcohol, but how do you get from just sort of a horrible scummy kind of alcohol thing to actually a really nice beer? Like, what is the process of brewing?
Well, it all starts with malted grains. So you get your grain, some barley or some wheat or oats or rice. Loads of different grains are used. Most beer is mainly based with barley. Then you dampen it a bit and let it germinate slightly and dry it out, and then it's malted. You mix all of those malted grains with some hot water, and that releases all the nice sugars. And then you run that out, so you've got this liquid free of all the grain. This nice sugary brown.
So the sugars
liquid
are coming from the grains.
Yep, the sugars are coming from the grains. You've got this nice sugary liquid, and then you put that in a big kettle, and you boil it for about an hour with hop flours.
I mean, how big are we talking with this kettle on an industrial scale?
So the
could kit, you sit inside it?
Oh, the kit that I brew on is 2,500 liters.
Wow,
which is fairly small.
Oh wow, okay.
Huge companies like AB InBev, who make Budweiser and such, and Foster's, I believe, they brew on things 10 times the size of that. They'll use our 2,500 liter kit just to keep their yeast healthy, basically. You've got your kettle, and you throw in some delicious hop flowers, which are what give us the flavour. And hops are a plant that have been cultivated throughout Europe for a long time. There's about 80 different types now commercially available. So you boil up your hops and your sugar water for about an hour, and then you cool it off, and you throw in your yeast at the temperature that the yeast is happy to grow out, between about 20-25 degrees for ales, a bit cooler for lagers, more like kind of 12 to 15 degrees. You let the yeasts do their job for 2 weeks or so, depending on the type of beer again.
2 weeks?
2 weeks.
I don't know why. In my head, I thought it was way longer. I think beer brewing took like months.
Yeah, you can do it in a week.
But I guess wine takes months. Maybe I'm just getting them confused.
Yeah. You can also do wine in a much shorter amount of time, but it probably wouldn't taste as nice. It's a similar thing with beer. You know, beer can be done quite quickly. But it's all about the taste after all. So after those 2 weeks, you let off some of the yeast, you cool it down so that the yeast deactivates and stops turning all the sugars into alcohol, and then you can carbonate it in one of a few ways. The first way is with ales. You put a little bit more sugar in it, and you put it in a sealed container called a cask. And then
Like the beer barrels?
The beer barrels, yeah. And then the CO2 that the yeast produces by just having an extra little bit of fermentation with that bit of extra sugar you've put in there forces the carbon dioxide into the beer. Or other beers are done with a process called lagering, which is how lagers are made. Now, the lager yeasts are much operate at much lower temperatures, so you have to cool the beer down much further in order to reduce the fermentation rate that the yeast is doing. And at lower temperatures, liquids are more likely to absorb gases. You said yesterday that was a bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, no, because I've always thought that a warmer body of water would be able to hold more carbon dioxide. And I thought that with like global warming and such, I guess actually no, as the seas are heating, they're releasing CO2.
Yeah. So I think the best way I would analogize it is we all remember the experiment of dissolving sugar into water.
Yeah.
And when it's warmer, it can do that much better.
Yeah.
So there you're going from a solid up to a liquid, whereas here you're going from a gas, down to a liquid.
Okay, so the energy transfer is different.
Exactly, the energy transfer is the other way around.
Got it. Okay, so you have it much cooler, and then it's naturally going to absorb more CO2.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know until I spoke to Chris. Actually, the easy difference between an ale and a lager is that lagers are fizzier and more carbonated. So there we go. And that CO2 is coming from another... it's a waste product from the same fermentation process. So the yeast is turning sugar into alcohol and carbon dioxide. And I guess the longer you let it go on, the more alcohol you get, the stronger your beer.
That can have an effect. Generally, it's done by having more sugar in the first place.
More sugar.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, so for now, let's have some more music. And I think an appropriate one would be apply some pressure, since that's what you've got to do. Get the carbon dioxide into the beer, wouldn't you agree?
It certainly is, yep.
Here we go, Max May Park.
You know that I would love to see you in that dress. Oh, but I would love to see you undress. What's my view? Well, how am I supposed to know? Write a review. Well, how objective can I be? What's my view? Well, how am I supposed to know? Write a review. Well, how objective can I be? I like to wait to see how things turn out. If you apply some pressure.
Probably one of my favourite songs when I was 17. Absolute blast from the past. If you've just tuned in, we asked you at the start, what is the ultimate hangover cure? I said mine was salty foods. Chris, what is yours?
Beer.
Drinking more beer?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, it seems appropriate that we should probably have some now.
Yeah.
What have you brought with you today?
So I've got two quite strong beers from the brewery where I work. One is a black IPA. Which is a very, very dark beer, but it's also quite thin and quite bitter and hoppy. So I can crack this open now.
Absolutely.
And pass it round.
Very nice. And if you could tweet us your hangover cures. So we had salty food and drinking more. We're now going to look at a little bit of a historical look, because right now brewing is all about kind of quantities and exact temperatures. But back in the day when people first discovered how to make alcohol, it was probably by accident. They probably just left a jar of honey or something else and accidentally got some yeast in it and then was covered and stored, and when they opened it again after storing it, they found that it had fermented, but actually kind of tasted okay and produced pleasing effects. And then through a process of trial and error and many different grains all over the world, different cultures have been making alcohol for centuries before we even understood what the process was. It's only in the last couple of hundred years that people have known what yeast is or that it was alive before it was considered to be a chemical. The word fermentation actually comes from the Latin fervor. I mean, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but yeah, fervor, fervory. And that means to boil. And this was because people observed that if you crushed grapes and left them in their vats, you'd actually get little bubbles forming. And we know these aren't bubbles of boiling, these are the bubbles of CO2 that the yeast is producing. And the yeast they got in there, the reason that they used their feet to crush it, well, A, it was quite good, but equally, they would have had natural yeast strains and other bacteria on their feet, and that would have helped to populate the wine that they were fermenting. But yeah, still people eventually realised that there was this yeast, this component that made things ferment, but they didn't call it yeast back then, they called it the ferment. And Samuel Johnson, in his first dictionary definition, described it as the ferment put into drink to make it work and into bread to lighten and swell it. So there we go. The ferment is what makes your drink work. And it was actually Louis Pasteur who first demonstrated that actually yeast was living and alive, and it was the crucial component into making alcohol, and that he also demonstrated that other bacteria made things that tasted not so nice, as we said, with the lactic acid. So that's just a brief look at where brewing has come from. But Amna, I believe you actually wrote a whole article on this and can probably do a much better job than me.
Yeah, so I looked at the evolution of beer. So scientists did a molecular analysis of yeast. So there's this contention with brewers. I don't know if you know about this, Chris, but there's two, particularly with lager, there's two main recognised types of yeast, and that's the Saaz and the Froberg lineages. And people were having this huge debate about whether yeast originated once or twice. So we have to figure this out. We had to go back to the 15th century.
So when you say originated, you mean like the species evolved?
Yeah.
So oh my God, so that'd be like two different forms of human evolving.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeast.
Yeah. And it was quite funny because I spoke to the researcher and, you know, he was just saying people have been unwittingly making yeast for like centuries and having no idea what, you know, the microbes inside of it. And he describes the invention of lager as an accident of history.
Yeah.
And it was during the 15th century that the Bavarians first noticed that the beer they were storing in caves during the winter continued to ferment. So like Chris said, when you make lager,
it's cooler temperature.
Exactly. And then they were like, oh, this is actually quite tasty. That's how lager was made.
So ale is the original.
Yes. And then they sequenced the genomes and they found that actually there were two different hybridization events. So what that basically means is that these two yeast have two different origins. So we made two different yeast by accident twice.
Oh my God. So there's actually two different varieties. And yeah. So the lager one is actually a different variety.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing. So right down at that microbial level, the difference between lager and ale is strong. Chris, is there like a sort of divide between lager lovers and ale lovers? Or is it just everyone loves all beer?
Traditionally, there has been seen as some divide, but
are we all friends these days?
I really see it as more of a divide between the big producers and the smaller producers. So, you know, all of the breweries that I've ever worked in, which have been quite small, have made a lager.
Uh-huh.
Big lager breweries don't tend to make any ales, but there are also big ale breweries. I suppose it's largely about what the public taste is.
Yeah. I can confirm this dark ale that you've brought today is absolutely delicious.
Thank you.
But we've always drunk a lot of beer in England. I think you were saying the other day it was safer to drink than water.
Yeah, so I think beer is quite culturally important in this country in the sense that the way it's grown up over the centuries has been because it was safer to drink than water in a country where we've got quite a significant risk of things like Legionnaire's disease because of our temperate climate. Water was often quite dangerous to drink, so beer was a way of making it safe. We didn't know why. We now know that it's because, first of all, you had to boil it, which killed all of the bacteria you didn't want. And then the yeast flourished and produced alcohol, which kept away different forms of bacteria and allowed it to be stored. And traditionally, it wouldn't have been flavoured with hops. You know, 800, 1,000 years ago, we wouldn't have used hops. It would have been things like fruits and spices and herbs and you know, bitter herbs.
That sounds really tasty. Why do we not do that anymore?
Some people do. But again, it's about what public tastes are. And people tend to want, you know, lighter, paler beers. But it would have also been a more kind of like gruel or porridge back then as well. You know, it would have been a meal. It would have been what you had at lunch, which would have been your main source of both water and
carbohydrate. It really used to be like a liquid bread?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, that's so cool. I never knew that. I mean, you hear that, I think the Weird Al song I played at the start of the show, beer is liquid bread, it's good for you. He has based that in historical accuracy.
Oh yeah.
Well done, Weird Al. Well done to you. What song do you want to play next, Chris?
Let's have Paper Planes, which is for my wife, because she likes it and so do I.
I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make them all day. I get one down in a second if you wait.
Summer Murder, indeed. So, Chris, what got you into brewing in the first place?
Well, I homebrewed for a little bit before I went to university. And while I was at university studying engineering, I drank a lot of beer during that time.
Which I can confirm.
And really, the craft brewery scene in London has absolutely exploded over the last few years.
Yeah, it really has.
I think it's 700% or something, the rise in breweries.
Really? As in, like, actual little breweries?
In the last 5 years, yeah.
Any idea why that is? Just, like, people are enjoying beer more?
Because it's cool. Because it's cool. It's already happened in, you know, it started in the States in the mid-late 80s, the craft brewery scene, Italy in the mid-90s, Canada. Germany's always had a strong connection with brewing, and they've been trundling on forever.
Is it like a kind of stand against the Tescos of the brewery world? Everyone wants to get the unique little local ones now.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And what is it that you really like about it and find interesting? I mean, I think it's fascinating anyway, I'm not saying it's not, but like, yeah. Well,
so I really love it from an engineering perspective.
Tell me about that.
So a lot of people who are professional brewers come from a bioscientific kind of background, biochemistry, things like that. It's all about the yeast for them. Whereas for me, studying thermodynamics, it's all about the heat transfer. So you have to do lots of heating and cooling when you're brewing. The way we've developed yeast over the centuries, if just left to its own devices, because we've made it so fervent in its ferment... I think they share the same root. Because we've made it so potent, it will produce enough heat to deactivate itself.
Oh, wow. So you've got to look after it.
So, yeah, so we have to cool it in order to make sure that it doesn't, you know, kill itself, basically. So that's that. You know, that's a challenge. Obviously, you've got to boil it. You've got to heat it up when you're mashing it. You've got to cool it down after you've boiled it. You've got to cool it again and find the right temperature again when you're conditioning it. So there's a lot of thermodynamics, a lot of heat transfer involved.
Have you ever made like a really horrendous batch?
Or
had any kind of like disasters, brewing disasters?
So when I was at uni, there was a party at my house once. Shout out to the Queen Mary Drama Society, I believe it was, who I wasn't involved in, but who were at my house for some reason. And someone, unbeknownst to me, threw up in my fermentation bucket.
Oh, my God. Did you then, you know, like, leave it for those 2 weeks and
so,
still think you were making beer?
So I sat for a few days before we were like, because, you know, my housemate's like, what is that smell? that spell has to be coming from somewhere. And is it your
fermentation? It's the really potent yeast.
Well, they were like, is it your fermentation? I was like, no, don't be ridiculous. Beer doesn't smell like that. You know, that's not what it is. And then eventually I looked in the bucket and, oh, yeah, there's just a lot of sick floating on top. And all of the yeast had kind of died, basically, probably from the stomach acids.
Well, very glad to hear that was actually at your house and not in the brewery where you know, have a 2,500-litre kettle of pomp.
Yeah, we have better standards than that.
And what would you say is your favourite type of beer?
Tricky question, a bit like asking someone who their favourite child is. I would say it's probably porter, very traditional London style of beer, very dark, quite strong. Named after the dock porters who loved it so much in the 1800s.
Cool. I've never tried it. I feel like I should go out and try it now.
Definitely.
And when you want to, like, flavour them, what do you, are you just literally, like, putting in other fruits and stuff? Is that how you flavour a beer?
So the flavour comes from the malt, depending on what types of malt you use, what grains, how those grains were malted. So most beer is a majority barley malt. To get most of the sugar from, but then you can throw in smoked barley malt or other types of paler malts or darker malts.
So it's all about the grain.
It's all about the grain.
And which grain? Off, which grain does porters use?
Porter uses dark and burnt, if you like, chocolate and caramel malts, they're called.
Sounds delicious.
So that's the sugar taste, and then you get the bitterness, which is from the different types of hops. There's about 80 hop varieties, I think, and more are being invented as we speak.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool. Do you ever like want to invent your own beer?
Yeah. So writing recipes is a normal part of a brewer's capacity. I'm not there yet, but I'm learning.
Cool. So we'll be looking out for the Chris Beer special in the future.
Yeah.
Right, well, it's coming up to the end of the show, which is super sad. But time to look at our yeast plume. Is it plume or bloom? Am I saying it wrong? Can it
technically
be both?
It's neither, I don't think.
Well,
I'd say bloom. But
yeah, what a fungi do. It's in the fungus kingdom, I think.
It is, a fungus. Yeah. Okay, so looking at it now, and we have got...
We've got a little bit of churning.
Yeah, like a sort of layer on the top of bubbly, kind of gloopy, opaque.
Mm. It's called Krausen.
A Krausen?
Yeah, which is German for crown. And the Germans obviously love their brewing, and they are kings at it. And because it's on top, they call it a crown.
Great, so we've got our crown, which just has been created just now from the yeast, breaking down the sugar. Yeah.
And if we left that for a few hours, it would grow, you know, 4 inches out of the top of the jug. It would really get huge.
Ours is currently 5 millimetres, but if you have tried this at home, leave it longer. So there we go. Oh, a little yeast churning away, doing their thing. Time to find out the ultimate hangover cures. Have we had any tweets in, Amna?
Oh, we have had actually a few tweets. Nathan's tweeted in saying, there is no cure, only suffering.
Oh, yep. I mean, it's better. Yeah, he's taking the realist approach. I still live in hope, though.
Yes, and Caroline Reed has come in saying, grilled sausage sandwich with cheese, warm. Chase away any hangover.
I could do that. That sticks with my salty food.
And Kyle's tweeted in, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, was Haya Jungguk is my hangover cure. Korean black pudding soup to chase away a hangover.
An exotic one. Wow. Can you even get that in London?
I wonder.
Oh, apparently so.
For me, I think it's just drinking a gallon of water before going to sleep.
That is true. The water, like, keep yourself hydrated. It really dilutes it all out. And my friend Johnny at work has texted saying...
Oh, yes. Johnny's coming in and he said... Paracetamol.
There we go. Living in modern times. They didn't have that back in the day. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Chris. Pleasure. It's been absolutely fascinating. And what final song do you want to play out on?
So this is for my friend Adam, who runs London's smallest commercial brewery, which is Degree Plato Brewing and Supplies. It's in Nettle Market in Hackney. And I do
awesome.
A bit, yeah, I do a bit of work with him. And it's R.E.M. and Losing My Religion, because we listen to lots of early 90s stuff.
That's me in the corner.